next day, Rabbi sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Coming to you from the 30th century inverted rocket ship clubhouse of the Legion of Superheroes, this is the 6th Long Box Graveyard Podcast. I am Paul O'Connor. I am your host here at Longbox Graveyard. This is the audio companion to my Longbox Graveyard blog, which you can find at www.longboxgraveyard.com, where I look at comic books. There's a new blog published every Wednesday at Longbox Graveyard. Mostly look at books from the 1970s, a lot of Marvels and some DCs. Check it out. I will be talking about my blog a little bit this month and also bringing you this month's feature, which is The Curse of the Marvel Value Stamp. Thank you for listening. I hope you all had a great Halloween. I celebrated by spamming my Instagram feed with monster pictures. If you didn't see them, why not? You can find my feed at longbox_graveyard on Instagram. If you want to know more about comics on Instagram, check my column at Longbox Graveyard from the 24th of October, which covers just that. Let's see, since I spoke to you last, I actually went to a comic book convention. I went to the inaugural San Diego Comic Fest, which was held in October. Talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show. I've been doing some reading, of course, not always for the blog. I have this self-perpetuating myth that I'm stuck in 1978, but I do read some more modern stuff. Of course, I read issues 1 to 48 of Walking Dead last summer, and I reviewed them in the Halloween edition of Longbox Graveyard. But I've also been reading some of the new 52 collections, all of which I quite enjoy. Well, mostly. I wasn't mad about Justice League Dark, but I liked Aquaman and Demon Knights, Batwoman, Frankenstein, Agent of Shade. It's a shame about Frankenstein being canceled. I thought that was a fun book. Back in my video game days, I helped run a studio called High Moon Studios, and we had a property that we created that I helped co-create called Dark Watch, which was a vampire western about an underground group of monsters that fought other monsters on behalf of humanity. And we tried to make that story work both as a video game, and it was okay as a video game. We actually did a comic book, too, did a one-shot in Heavy Metal. But we could never quite get the tone right of our vampire, gunslinger, secret agent, steampunk hero. And here I am reading Frankenstein, Agent of Shade all these years later, and I thought they nailed it. I thought it was the best Dark Watch comic I'd ever read, and I really enjoyed the first five issues of that series. I'm sorry that it didn't make it through. I also have Animal Man, Swamp Thing sitting on the stand for me to read. It's been fun to plunge into these new 52s. An interesting thing about the new 52 books is with my buddy Chris Ulm, who's been a guest on the blog a couple times, and is himself former editor-in-chief of Malibu Comics. Chris and I have both been buying New 52 trade paperbacks, and we read them, and then we trade them back and forth. So it feels kind of like we're, you know, comic book kids from the 1960s or something, buying books and swapping them. We do everything short of right off to the treehouse and read them together. We don't fold them and put them in our back pocket or get them wet at the old swimming hole or anything like that. But it does feel kind of old-fashioned to be reading comics with another person, even though he's 50 instead of a kid. 49, sorry, Ulmster. I didn't mean to make you old before your time. But it's unusual to be reading comics with somebody else and swapping them back and forth. And it's interesting, to me at least, because, of course, I'm a proponent of digital comics, which I've talked about a number of times here on the podcast. But it's undeniable that it is difficult to share your enthusiasms in comics if they're digital. The nature of the rights management, for the legitimate books at least, discourages being able to easily share something with someone that you're enthusiastic about. But with these new 52 trade paperbacks, they're easy for me to buy a few, and the owner buys a few, and we read them, and we swap them back and forth and talk about them. So that's been cool. Also, more recently, I've read Ed Brubaker's Criminal, Actually, I have the second volume of Criminal on my shelf. I read the first volume some time ago. Recently finished his Incognito, which I thought was pretty good. I'm kind of a geek for Brubaker, so anything that's got his name on it is going to get attention from me. And I even read the first collection of Saga, which, of course, is the big indie it book these days. And I liked it enough. I'm looking forward to the next collection. So maybe I'm more up to date than you suspect. But just to keep things in balance, I'm also reading Volume 1 of the DC Legion of Superhero Archives, which are Superboy comics from the late 50s and early 60s, introducing the Legion of Superheroes. I do this to maintain my self-respect and be able to look myself in the eye in the morning, make sure that I stick to the past, which is, after all, where I'm most comfortable, and presumably your interest for joining me here on the Long Box Graveyard podcast. So that's a look at the present, even if the present is mostly about looking backwards for me. Let's get on to the future, or at least the news. What's coming up at Long Box Graveyard?
It's all I ever have. Redemption songs. Redemption songs.
Well, the first thing on the site will be the panel gallery of Nick Fury by Steranko. Now, technically, this is already up. It went up on the 7th of November. But it'll only be up a few days by the time you listen to this podcast, if you're listening when the podcast first goes up. So I thought I'd plug it anyway. Also, technically, it was a late change to my lineup when I did the news last month. I think I advertised something else appearing in this slot. But at the last second, I decided to go with the Steranko panel gallery. It's really cool. It's just images from Jim Steranko's run on, primarily on Strange Tales, following Jack Kirby's run on that book, and also the first couple issues of the eponymous Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. book from the 1960s. Just individual frames that caught my attention, blown up big and beautiful for you to evaluate. Steranko, of course, I forget who wrote this, but I read once that Steranko's comic work was like a karate chop to the throat of the comics establishment when it came out in the 60s. It was very modern for its time. It's still very modern, and it's worth remembering and looking at. So the panel gallery, Nick Fury by Steranko, is running on Long Box Graveyard on the 7th. On the 14th of November will be another Master of Kung Fu review, this time Mordillo's Island. One of the, maybe it's a lesser Master of Kung Fu story, but even lesser Master of Kung Fu is fun. So check out Mordillo's Island on Long Box Graveyard 1114 as I continue with my ending of the year resolution to spend more time looking at Master of Kung Fu, one of my favorite books in the 1970s. Following that, on the 21st, I think, will be a new feature type called Project Greenlight, which is when I get together with some of my partners in crime, the aforementioned Chris Ulm, also Tom Mason, who was the creative director at Malibu Comics, a good friend of mine. Tom and Chris and I get together for an email chain, and we construct a plausible pitch for a Silver Age comic book property to be brought to the movie screen. And of course, we're no strangers to superheroes on movie screens these days, but there's still some B and C list characters that neither Marvel nor DC have saw fit to bring to the screen yet. So on the 21st, I'll be giving you my pitch for why I think Doctor Strange would make a great subject for a movie, and Chris and Tom will be there to either support me or shoot it down. So that's Project Greenlight, I think, on the 21st, assuming I can get it written before I get out of town. I'm about halfway done with that blog, so I'm optimistic that you'll see it on the 21st at Long Box Graveyard. Greenlight, Doctor Strange, the 28th, and these dates are all Wednesdays, by the way. You always find a new blog at Long Box Graveyard on a Wednesday. On the 28th of October, to finish out the month, there will be a review of more issues of Tomb of Dracula. I did a review of Tomb of Dracula last month, just before Halloween. Broke down a few issues. I'm going to continue my series on Tomb of Dracula with a review I'm tentatively calling The Vengeance of Dracula, although that may change, where I look at a few more issues of Tomb of Dracula, the Immortal series from the 1970s by Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan, Tom Palmer, one of my favorite books in the 1970s, and also a book that I've resolved to pay more attention to, along with Master of Kung Fu, as Long Box Graveyard moves on in through the end of the year. So Vengeance of Dracula on the 28th is coming up. Looking forward into December, on the 5th of December, probably another panel gallery. It's possible I'll move this up. Publication plans pending, but panel gallery of Button Men this time. I don't know why, it's a strange obsession, but I've been on the lookout for comic book panels with evil supervillains pushing buttons. And I found a lot of them, so I'm going to share those with you. It's, you know, these are my pathologies. I have to live with them, and you have to see them at Longbox Graveyard on the 5th of December. Panel gallery, Button Men. And then on the 12th will be the Longbox Soapbox. And this is a, you know, it's a blog for the hardcore only. I do one of these every 6 months. So the 12th of December will mark the 18th month anniversary of Longbox Graveyard. It will mark 18 months of weekly publication of the blog on Wednesdays. So once every 6 months, I do a Longbox Soapbox where I look at the blog. I blog about the blog itself. I blog about blogging. So, you know, if you're a blog wonk, this is for you. I look at my numbers. I evaluate trends. I tell you what's coming up. There will be some changes coming up on Longbox Graveyard, so be sure to tune in to see what they will be. I'll leave you in suspense if I'm going to continue the blog past its 78th installment or not. I will say only that what I do with each Longbox soapbox is I sign another contract with myself. I bite this blog off in 6 month chunks, and I say I'm going to write 6 months, no matter what, hell or high water. And then at the end of that 6 months, I reevaluate and decide if I want to continue with the project. So Longbox Graveyard is coming up for its third renewal. Join me on the 12th for the Longbox Soapbox, where I'll give you the long and short of the past and future of Longbox Graveyard. Also, there will be a new Dollar Box column on the 5th of December over at stashmycomics.com. I won't commit to what it's going to be because I don't know yet. Last month, I told you that I'd be reviewing Alan Moore's Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow for my November Dollar Box. But I ended up going an entirely different direction, which I'll talk a little bit more about during this month's feature. So I'll just say, check out my new Dollar Box column at stashmycomics.com on December 5th, and be surprised by whatever it is I wind up reviewing. The subject of Dollar Box is single or short issue runs of comics with an original cover price of a dollar or less. And as you can tell, at a dollar or less, that pretty much confines me to Silver and Bronze Age comics, which is my wheelhouse. It's the stuff I love. I try to find individual issues that I think are worthy for one reason or another and put them in front of you. So join me over at Stash My Comics. It's a good site, and I'm happy that they host my column over there on a monthly basis. All right, so that's the news. That's what's coming up. Let's go on with this month's feature, which is The Curse of the Value Stamp.
Because all I ever have, redemption songs. Redemption songs.
Our comic book hobby is bracketed by objective valuations. There's a pretty clear consensus for grading comics on a 10-point scale. And while you and I might argue over whether a book is a 4.5 or a 5.0, there is a clear and objective methodology for grading books that looks at things like cover gloss, staples, white pages, nicks and tears, etc. The Comics Guarantee Company will professionally grade your books for a price and encase them in a plastic slab to preserve their condition, and also to remind us of Atomic War if we choose to break open one of the slabs. Those CGC slabs, if you've ever seen them, they're like something out of a submarine movie. Like one of those plastic keys they take out of the Doomsday Vault and snap open before they dial in their targets for ICBM strikes. I don't have any of them. Maybe I should someday. It strikes me as a little crazy to take my most precious books and encase them in a piece of plastic, but I understand that the idea is that they're graded, they're put in plastic. That preserves the grade. If you snap open the book, the plastic, to read the book, that's fine, but then it has to be regraded before it goes back in the slab, and it's fine. It's important for collectors, especially for these extraordinarily valuable Golden Age and Silver Age books. Anyway, if the value of your comic has been decided, you can determine the par price of your book, whether it's, you know, Human Fly number one, CGC 8.0 versus a Double Dinosaur number one, CGC 7.5. You consult the venerable Overstreet Price Guide, which is still published in a thick as a brick Dead Tree edition, or you can trust to one of the more convenient but less prestigious online guides like comicspriceguide.com to see how much you can pay or ask for your precious comics. And, you know, there's a big difference, of course, between asking and selling, as any poor devil who has braved eBay to sell comics will tell you, myself included. But so respected are the objective price guides that you can even insure your comics' treasures or sell them to pay off back taxes if you need be, as was the fate of actor Nicolas Cage's copy of Action Comics No. 1, sold online in 2011 for $2.16 million. Now, that price seems kind of crazy to me, but I guess it makes a kind of sense. Books like Action No. 1 or Amazing Fantasy No. 15 or Fantastic Four No. 1 or Detective 27, these are authentic cultural artifacts that are linked to our past. They're genuinely scarce and legitimately esteemed by collectors. Much as I've dreamed of finding a box of forgotten Golden Age books in my grandmother's attic, I've never owned such an expensive comic myself. I did once find original matte paintings from Forbidden Planet in my grandmother's closet, but that's a different story. No, I've never owned a comic remotely so valuable as one of those gold or silver age keys, but I do own one of the more sought-after comics of the Bronze Age, Incredible Hulk number 181. By any standard, Hulk number 181 is a crappy comic. The Hulk battles a Z-list Canadian werebeast called the Wendigo in a by-the-numbers Len Wein story illustrated by the sturdy but unspectacular Herb Trimpe. Now, I'm going to take a little diversion here because I don't mean to pick on Herb, but this book isn't his best work. However, I'm going to put in a plug for the aforementioned Dollar Box column over at StashMyComics.com, the column that was published there earlier this month. I record this, it's November of 2011, or 2012, excuse me. The issue, or the review that was published over there was of Hulk number 138, which was illustrated by Herb, with a script by Roy Thomas. And it's an issue that proves that Trimpe could be quite the artist when he wasn't on the rat wheel grinding out too many pages a week for Marvel. It's a terrific book. It's a real gem. It's worth taking a look at. I hope you'll take a look at that review. Anyway, if Hulk 138 was a high point for Mr. Trimpe, Hulk number 181, not so much. It's a typical Bronze Age comic, Bronze Age Hulk comic at least. Forgettable script, unspectacular art, Hulk smash, blah, blah, blah. According to comicspriceguide.com, and I'm using them because I'm too cheap to buy a copy of Overstreet, a mythical graded gem mint copy of Hulk number 181 could command a price of more than $20,000 American. Of course, those copies don't exist, but a slabbed and graded copy in fine or near mint condition might run you $1,500 or $2,000. So why the high prices? Well, this issue of Incredible Hulk, as all comic geeks know, features the first full appearance of Wolverine, the most popular character that Marvel's created in the last 40 years, arguably the only great Marvel character created after their Spider-Man, Hulk, Fantastic Four, etc. Silver Age heyday. Now, I like Wolverine plenty. I'm not especially an X-Men guy. But it's cool to own this precious pop cultural artifact, which I have through no fault of my own. I bought it off the rack for a quarter in the summer of 74. I've never treated my comics like museum pieces, and this book, like the rest, was knocked around from box to box before finding its way into a comics bag and stuffed into a long box sometime in the late 1970s. Of course, the book's been read, probably a time or two, passed around, generally treated like a comic book, instead of a Gutenberg Bible signed and numbered by the original author. I took decent care of my stuff for a kid. My copy might qualify for a very good grade of 4.0, maybe even a 5, as it roughly fits this description. I think this is from comicspriceguide.com. So let's see, my copy of Hulk 181, let's look at it. Book is complete, but with major creases and or spine roll. Yeah, I think that's probably true. I don't think it lies entirely flat. There is almost low cover gloss at most times or none at all. Yeah, it's an old book. The inside paper quality is not good and yellow, and small pieces of them may be missing. Yeah, I might get a plus out of this. Good shape interior, a little yellow, but not too bad. If there's a piece missing from the cover, it should be no larger than 1/2 inch to 1/4 inch. No pieces are missing from the cover. Books in this grade are almost always creased, scuffed, abraded, and soiled, but completely readable. Tape on the comic is considered a defect in this grade, and a defect to me, too. There's no tape on my comics, let me tell you. But, I don't know, maybe it's soiled. I don't want to explain why. So, as such, my ungraded copy of Hulk number 181 might be worth around $200, more or less. Not so great compared to $20,000 for that mythical gem mint, but still a pretty good deal when you consider the comic has realized an 80,000% increase in value over the 25 cents I paid for it in 1974. But, that's a big but. I don't have a big but this is a big but. my copy of Hulk number 181 isn't even worth $200. There's a problem. There's a problem on the letters page. Not because of anything that's on the letters page, because of something that's missing from the letters page. My copy of Hulk number 181 doesn't rate better than a 1.5, worth maybe $30 or $40, because I cut the Marvel value stamp from the letters page of Hulk number 181. Yes, the Marvel value stamp, the bane of Bronze Age Marvel collectors. The Marvel value stamp program was an idea that Marvel dreamed up in the 1970s, specifically 1974 to 1976. There were 100 stamps in their Series A. There was also a Series B, which looked like puzzle pieces, but they weren't as cool. I'm interested in Series A here. And by the way, there's a great site on the web, mvstamps.com, that has all this stuff and more. I'll put it in the show notes. And thanks to them, because I'm pulling a lot of this information that I didn't know about value stamps on that particular website. Anyway, so in the 1970s, Marvel dreamed up the scheme that they would get kids to go out and buy comics they might not normally purchase because they would contain these rare, valuable Marvel value stamps. I mean, the name's right there. It's a value stamp. It's not just a stamp. It's a value stamp. You got to have it. So they drive kids to buy all these different books across their line because they were collecting these stamps that they were supposed to cut out and put in books, like stamp books. There was a time when stamp collecting was an actual hobby in this country. Kids could emulate it by collecting their own Marvel stamps. They were about, they weren't the size of actual postage stamps. They were maybe an inch by an inch or so. They were printed on Marvel Comics letter pages primarily. They chew up like a, you know, a quarter or an eighth of the letters page. They looked like a stamp. They had the outline that looked like a stamp. They're all numbered from number 1 to 100. Number 1 was The Amazing Spider-Man, Natch, as they said in their editorial copy at the time. And the subject of stamp number 100 was a deeply shrouded secret. Ended up being Galactus. Spoiler, sorry. But then, of course, they trumpeted them all on the web pages about how it was important that you have to have this thing. They sold you a little book through the mail that you could keep them all cut out and pasted in. They made vague promises about how valuable a full book of value stamps might be. It's ironic. Marvel editorial at the time trumpets how Fantastic Four number 1 is going for the princely sum of $50 in some comic stores right now. So you can only imagine how valuable it'll be to have a booklet full of Marvel value stamps. But of course, it had exactly the opposite effect, because you cut your stamp out of a book, you destroy its value, which I did. I was 12 in 1974, so of course I did this. And I never even did get a full book of value stamps. I remember I was very excited when I, on a whim, bought Submariner number 72, I think. Maybe it was 73. In any case, it was the last issue in Submariner's run. And I just bought it on a whim and flipped to the letters page, and there was Marvel value stamp number 100. I mean, I felt like I'd found a ticket to the Irish lottery. Cut it out, of course. Put them in the book that I bought, which I can't even find now in this ridiculous accumulation that I call a comic book collection. And looking back on it, I took such care in cutting out these stamps. I was so loving in my care. I didn't just take a scissors to it and hack that stamp out. I took the page I just separated the page out from the rest of the book, so just the page was sticking out, everything was kind of folded back, and I put the page on a little plastic box that I had. And I had a straight razor, which, you know, should have used to cut my throat, but instead I used it to cut out these Marvel value stamps. I cut them out very carefully. And I remember doing this so that the integrity of the page was maintained. I didn't cut into the page and then cut around the stamp. I was very careful to cut the stamp out in these little straight lines. And then I'd store the thing in the little plastic box, and eventually I taped them all into this book. I really didn't understand what I was doing. Actually, I know exactly what I was doing. I was a kid and I was having fun. I remember cutting the stamps out and licking them, because they were called stamps after all. So I thought you'd lick them and you could stick them into the silly booklet. But of course they were just, you know, go look a comic book page. It's not tasty. It's not even psychedelic, unfortunately. It's just a regular old stupid comic book page. And you'd cut it up and you'd tape it into this book. They had vague promises about it being useful. Doing a little research, it turns out they offered discounted admission to a couple Comic-Cons, San Diego Comic-Con and a New York show. Okay, whatever. So I will admit, sure, I had fun in the summer of 74 collecting these things and cutting up the comics. I must have had a little twinge at the time because I wouldn't have taken such care cutting the stamp out if I didn't think that the integrity of the book was something worth preserving. It didn't stop me from chopping them up. And all these years later, I've got a bunch of books from 74 and 75, and they're cut up. Most of them are cut up. The only ones that were saved from my slashing rampage were those that didn't have a value stamp on the letters page or had a stamp that was reproduced. I think, this is a vague memory, maybe there was, I want to say that sometimes the stamps were published in more than one place and I didn't cut them out if I had them twice, but I could be wrong on that. So, how does it make me feel to have all these comics that are cut up? Well, you know, I've talked a lot on the show about ownership, the illusion of ownership, subversive agenda has been to try to convince myself primarily, but maybe also convince you in this kind of therapeutic podcast way that value should be subjective rather than objective, that value should reside in what something means to me rather than what it means to the world. I've talked about how I don't really need to own precious Silver Age key issues. I mean, they're beautiful. I'd love to have them, but I can enjoy them in the store. It's just nice to be in the presence of one at a store at a show or something. I don't need to have all these things myself locked away in my little man cave. And this extends to my feelings about digital comics as well. I believe ownership is an illusion. You can go back and listen to the 6.5 hours of Longbox Graveyard podcast that precedes this particular show if you're interested in those particular rantings. So if value in collectibles, especially in comic books, 25-cent raggedy old comic book from the 70s, if I believe that value in these things is purely subjective, I shouldn't be upset that pieces from them are cut. But I will admit I'm struggling with this. I'm having a hard time with it. And when I see these books, when I'm going through the collection and bagging and boarding them, and I open the pages and I flip to them, I think, oh, did I not? Maybe I didn't cut this one up. Oh, yeah. And then I get to the letters page and it's got a hole in it. And I go, yeah, okay. It doesn't make me feel great. But you know what makes me feel worse is when I get a comic in the mail from eBay or something and I flip to the letters page and some kid's hacked that value stamp out and he didn't even take that care to cut it with a straight razor. It makes me so angry. And that I feel worse, I get more angry about a book that someone else has defaced than the book that I've defaced helps me kind of circle in on maybe the subjective value thing isn't so far out. Because what is the value of a collectible? Is it the object itself, or is it the cultural significance of the object? I'd argue it's more that than the object. But even more so, I'd argue that it's what it means to you. It's the memory. That this collectible is it's a reservoir for your memories and for your feelings, for your nostalgia. And here we really are getting into subjective value. When I see a comic that some other person has carved up, I get angry. When I see a comic that I've carved up, I might get angry, but I'm getting angry at myself when I was 12 years old. And at least I'm thinking about what it was like to be 12 years old in my house in Hollywood, in the summertime, bringing home a stack of comics from World News newsstand at the corner of Hollywood and Coinga Boulevards in a little brown paper bag, going into my room, sliding them out, laying on my bed, the sun shining in through the window slats, flipping through the books and being transported away to these crazy comic book adventures. That was a pretty good year. It's a pretty good time. I've said in the past the golden age of everything is 12. Not an original sentiment, but it's no less true for that. So I can buy myself off and say, yeah, well, I remember cutting up my comic books, but I get angry when I see someone else has done it. And this puts me in mind of something happened a little bit later in my life after I became a father. My first boy, Miles, who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Miles is 15 now. He shared a special hour with me where we talked about Frank Miller's Holy Terror. When Miles was a baby, he smashed a clock that I had at my house. I didn't have a lot of money when Miles was young. I still don't have a lot of money. But we were really strapped, as, a couple with their first children often do. But Rita and I set aside some money, and we bought this little clock in a gift store in a town we lived in Central California, in Cambria, California. We lived on the coast. And it was a tourist town, but we were locals. And we'd go into the tourist town on weekdays when the crowds had cleared out. We went into a gift store, and we found this little clock that we liked. It was made out of cherry wood, I think, and kind of hand-tooled and looked a little California craftsman style. And it probably cost some unattainable sum, like $24 or $28 or something. It seemed like a lot of money to us, but we decided, you know, we can tighten our belt. We kind of like this, and we'd like to buy something for ourselves. So just as an act of optimism, we bought this clock. We brought it home, put it on our mantle or whatever, and enjoyed it. And then a couple years later, Miles is he's a toddler and a terror, and he gets a hold of the clock and he breaks it. I remember the first I found the clock, it was it was sitting on our piano, and I looked at it and said, that seems kind of lopsided. Did you know what's going on? And I picked it up, and the back fell out, and the batteries fell on the floor, and I realized that the clock had been dropped, and Miles had probably panicked and patched the thing back together as best he could and put it on the shelf like, you know, like a kid would, or Homer Simpson. It was like that when I got here, sir. And I was disappointed because this is why we can't have nice things. We certainly didn't have a lot of nice things, and it hurt because we'd spent a lot of money on this. But rather than get enraged at this little boy that I love so much, he's just a little kid. He wasn't out smashing my stuff on purpose. He wasn't being careless. I don't think he was. And I looked at that broken clock, and I thought, you know, I could get really, really angry right now that this thing, this artificial thing made by someone I don't know and put on a shelf that I bought with money, I could get very upset that this thing has been broken. Or I could look at this thing and I could say it's now unique. It's now different. It's now personal because my little boy broke it. You know, he kind of scarred it. And it's no longer perfect. It's just a different shape. It's a different form. It still works, still performs its function. It's still a receptacle for memories, and maybe no longer an object of pride of ownership or an expression of optimism for the future, but it does suddenly represent feelings about my son. And I wasn't buying it either. I mean, I tried real hard to feel that way. I remember trying to convince Rita of it, and she just looked at me like I had two heads. What's wrong with you? But it's not like being angry is going to bring the clock back. So I tried to think about that way for a while. And, you know, eventually the clock just kind of disintegrated, and it was kind of discouraging to see it all the time. We ended up getting rid of it, regretfully. You know, Miles grew up against all expectations. And I still think about that clock every once in a while, and the way I tried to think about it being defaced or damaged or destroyed. And I try to bring that same perspective to my comic books, to my many comic books from that lost summer of 74 that have been carved up by a little kid with a straight razor because he was a kid. That's what kids do. So, I'm still conflicted. You can tell I'm still conflicted. I am looking to replace my damaged copies from the summer of 74 with better quality copies in my collection. In the meantime, I'm happy to have the ones I have. Of course, purchase of a Hulk 181 is beyond my means. Fortunately, I'm not that crazy about that particular issue. It's cool enough to have it. Put it in a bag. You can look at the cover, and from the outside, you might think it's worth more. Certainly, it's worth something to me. And there's a hidden value of the story. The hidden value of the story, of course, is if I had a copy of Hulk number 181 that was worth thousands of dollars, that'd be a pretty good story. Oh, look at that. Wow, it's a genuine collectible. And, you know, I sold it, and then I bought something, or put it to my kid's tuition, or you know, whatever it was. I mean, that's a story you like to tell. But you tell that story over Thanksgiving dinner, who really wants to hear it? It's like, okay, you know, weird Uncle Paul, he had this old comic book he sold for a bunch of money. Well, good for him. It's a better story if you can tell someone, as I have with you, that, gee, I got this comic book in perfect condition. It's worth $20,000. Really? $20,000? Yeah, mine's worth $20. Why? Well, thereby hangs a tale. There's a story to tell. And that's the hidden value of my copy of Hulk number 181. By cutting it up, I created a story that I've been dining out now for, you know, 35 years. My kids know it. My kids don't know much about my comic book collection, but they can tell you about that issue of Hulk that their old man carved up, Knucklehead Dad. And of course, it's like a fish story. Every year it gets bigger. As far as they're concerned, that comic is probably worth $2 million by now. It's like Action Comics number one. So they have an interest in the comic because I carved it up. And that's a hidden value of the story of Hulk number 181. It's been a family story, and now it's a story I've shared with you too. So it's a story that keeps on giving. I mean, really, compared to a comic that would just be in a bag someplace, maybe that's not such a bad trade-off. At least I'm working real hard to believe that. So, you know, don't poke any holes in this particular bubble. I'm just now getting over carving up my comics. And I am trying to think about how this relates to my belief that ownership's an illusion and that we're possessed by our possessions and etc. Clearly I'm possessed by these comics that I've cut up with my razor blades. It's an ongoing process. It's a work in progress, just like the whole Longbox graveyard experiment. So that's our story. The curse of the Marvel value stamp. They continue to curse me, continue to vex me. My advice to you as collectors, of course, is if you are looking at Marvel Comics from the years 1974 to 1976, do not buy them sight unseen. Make sure that you can put eyes on the letters page at least, and make sure that, you know, that some little kid, maybe me, hasn't carved the Marvel value stamp out of the book. All right, so that just about done here. We're going to do the plug of the month and some news, where to find me, and then we'll be wrapping it up until December. The plug of the month this time is for the San Diego Comic Fest. Now, it's a little strange to plug something that's come and gone, but I do so by encouraging them to do it again. So the San Diego Comics Fest, then you can go to www.sdcomicfest.org if you want to see their website. It was on October 19th through 21st in San Diego, California, at the Town and Country Resort and Convention Center, which was this cool little motor hotel that's like the land that time forgot. It reminded me of when I used to come down to San Diego with my parents in the 70s. The San Diego Comic Fest, it says right here on their masthead, it's an old-school Comic-Con brought to you by some of the same folks who produced Comic-Con in the 70s. And the San Diego Comic Fest was founded as a deliberate reaction to complaints that a lot of people, myself included, have voiced about San Diego Comic-Con International, which is undeniably a singular event, wonderful show. That I'm, you know, very honored to go to every year, living in San Diego as I do, and going for free because of my marginal pro status that the con committee continues to honor, and I appreciate all those things. But I have taken the convention to task in the past, both on my blog and on this podcast, because it's gotten just so big and so crowded, and maybe has lost sight of its roots a little bit, which are about comic books and love of comic books and celebrating the artists who make them. And certainly those events still occur at Comic-Con, and it is a mecca for comic fans, I agree. But those of us that have the first world problem of being able to complain about comic books or Comic-Con will tell you that the show has become a real grind. And maybe, as sacrilegious as it may be to suggest, maybe not even worth attending any longer. So the folks behind San Diego Comic Fest decided to put their money where their mouth was and said, you know what, let's turn back the clock. Let's start a tiny little convention that's dedicated to comics and the people who love them, the people who make them, and see who shows up. So they couldn't have it at the El Cortez Hotel in San Diego, where the Comic-Con really flourished back in the old days. So I think the El Cortez is a condominiums now. But they found this Town and Country Resort Center, and they put on a little convention. They're probably, I don't know if they ever published numbers, but I wouldn't expect there were more than 300 or 500 people there. I went down on Saturday with my buddy Chris Alm, my little boy Jack, and his daughter Sarah. And we spent the day there, and boy, I gotta tell you, I just had a grand time on Saturday. I went to two panels. There was a panel from a gentleman, I think from UCSD. I hope I didn't get his university wrong. One of the San Diego universities, and he teaches a class there about Star Trek and pop culture. God bless the university system. You know, he's a smart guy, and he loved his Star Trek, and he put on a nice presentation for an hour where he was talking about the relevance of Star Trek, its continuing relevance, how it's tackled these different issues through the years and how it's changed with the times. It was a scholarly talk, very welcome. He talked for an hour and he showed some clips from the show, which I loved, of course, because I'm a big fan of the original series. And then at the end of the talk, he opened it up to questions, and, you know, somebody in the back raised his hand and said, yeah, who's going to be in the next movie? You know, so. So he answered that question with patience. And I thought the man and the hour have met. I am in this room to ask this Star Trek professor an academic question by God. And I raised my hand and I asked him a question. I said, I'm just trying to remember how I put the question. I said, I want to ask you a question about the Prime Directive. And I'd like to know if you feel that the Prime Directive, which is set up primarily as a set of dramatic guardrails in the original series to create tension and define what the characters cannot do, do you think the Prime Directive is in any way related to American foreign policy in Southeast Asia in the 1960s? And does it offer an endorsement, implied or otherwise, on behalf of the show creators for American foreign policy in Indochina? And the guy's eyes lit up, you know, like he hit the jackpot. Wow, how come I don't get questions like this in school? And then he went off and talked all about Prime Directive and how it tied into LBJ's Vietnam policy. And boy, it was just great. So it was great to be in the audience for that. And then later that day, there was also a panel that was put on about the 75th anniversary of Daffy Duck, put on by a gentleman whose name I can't remember. I think he has a website called cartoonbrew.com, which I need to visit. But he was another guy that was just a wealth of knowledge, totally committed to his field, really knew these cartoons inside and out, was happy to share his enthusiasms with us and, you know, show us cartoons with Daffy Duck kissing Hitler. And, well, it was just a lot of fun. And then in between, there was a small but marvelously well-curated dealer's room, which had comics really just from the 60s. It was bereft of a lot of the kind of disposable action figure junk that you see at Comic-Con. Not that there's anything wrong with action figures, but geez, row after row after row of stuff that's covered with dust that obviously hasn't sold for a reason. It's not a collectible make. At the Comic Fest, I really felt like the things that were in front of me were genuine collectibles, and because of that, I opened my wallet and paid a little more than maybe I would have liked, just to support the dealers, and I walked away some issues of Captain Marvel and some other comics I've been seeking. So just had a great time at the Comic Fest. I was only there for the day. It is a three-day show. I'm not sure that 3 days, you know, by the end of the third day, I might be wondering what I was doing down there. But, of course, it'd be driven by friends. And if there were more people there than I knew, I'd have a great time. Small venue, really easy to get around. No parking troubles. Reasonable price, I think it was $20, $25 for the day. Maybe that's a little extreme. But I looked at it as a donation to a worthy effort and to pay for the programming. And the money I spent in the dealer's room was just icing on the cake to try to encourage the dealers to come back. I really hope that they put on another San Diego Comic Fest in October of 2013. Looking at their Twitter feed, I gather that that's on the agenda. They intend to do it. I hope they do, and I hope if you're in the San Diego area, you'll come out. Maybe convince me to do 3 days there next time, because it was a good time. So that's Plug of the Month from Longbox Graveyard, the San Diego Comic Fest. And you can go to, as I said, www.sdcomicfest.org. And check it out, and you can see at least the programming that they had there this year past, and get a sense of what that was all about. So, that's just about it. A busy month coming up for me. I am traveling next week on Thursday, the 15th of November. I am boarding a plane for Shanghai, China. I've never been to Asia before. I'm very excited about this. I've been invited out there to speak at the Game Developers Conference in Shanghai. Some of you may know, in my secret identity, I am an iPhone game developer. So I'm flying out there to give a very boring talk on monetization of iOS game apps. I won't bore you with the details, but if you're in China, feel free to drop by. Also that day, the next game from my company, Appy Entertainment, launches wide. It's a game called Animal Legends. I hope you'll check it out. It's a free game. It's one of these, one of these pernicious free-to-play games that get you hooked and then commits the unpardonable sin of asking you for a dollar or two for the tens or hundreds of hours of joy that you've had by purchasing virtual currency, which you can spend on all sorts of cool stuff inside the game. So check it out. It's called Animal Legends. If you have an iPhone or an iPad, please give it a try. Anyway, I'm excited because I'll be traveling. This is putting a little pinch on my geek life. That's why I was a little vague about exactly what's coming up at Longbox Graveyard. I will still keep a monthly schedule or weekly publication schedule. I'm not exactly sure what's going to be up there. I'll also continue to post to Twitter, even though it's going to be Doombots and LMDs that are posting there. It won't actually be me, but I do keep things going on my Twitter stream just to drive traffic back to the site. So if you and I are people that normally converse on Twitter and I'm not that responsive, it's because I'm in communist China. Give me a break. So that's coming up for me. And of course, Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving to you all. And thank you for listening to the Longbox Graveyard podcast. Where to find me? Of course, I'll be back here next month for another Longbox Graveyard podcast. In the meantime, if you want more Longbox Graveyard, enter Longbox Graveyard into Google. You'll get 6 pages of hits. All about me. That's crazy. all about Long Box Graveyard, all the crazy places I am. I'm on Facebook, Google+, Tumblr, MySpace, though I'm just a ghost there. My most active channels are on Twitter as @LBoxGraveyard. You'll find me on Instagram as Longbox_Graveyard. You'll find me in my Dollar Box column over at Stash My Comics. And of course, the mothership is my blog, www.longboxgraveyard.com. Thanks, as always, to Mo Christensen for engineering and posting the show. Continuing the Thanksgiving theme, I'm very thankful for Mo and all the guys at the We Talk Comics Podcast Network. Even though they're Canadian, which means they celebrated Bizarro Thanksgiving in October, I don't care. I'll still wish them a happy American Thanksgiving. And the same to you, my loyal listeners and readers. Thank you for listening. This has been the Long Box Graveyard Podcast. Until next month, I will see you in the funny papers.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Old pirates, yes, they rob I.
Sold I to the merchant ships.
Minutes after they took I
from a bottomless pit.
How long shall they kill our prophets
while we stand aside and look?
Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs.
All I ever had,
redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.